I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The World doesn't usually air long interviews, but today we're making an exception. That's because the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba touches American foreign policy in so many profound ways, whether you're talking hunger strikers or indefinite detention and how that has affected the perception of the U.S. around the globe, or the five Taliban detainees who were recently released from Guantanamo in exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who, by the way, arrived back in the U.S. today. The woman you're about to hear from has covered Guantanamo since even before the first detainees got there in 2002. Carol Rosenberg is with the Miami Herald, and she knows the Gitmo story like no other reporter. Starting with why Guantanamo became a detention center in the first place, the U.S. needed a prison for extremists captured during the new military offensive in Afghanistan.
A month after the September 11th attacks, the Bush administration was just overwhelmed in Afghanistan with prisoners, and they decided that the best thing to do was pick up and move prisoners 8,000 miles to this base in the corner of Cuba, because they thought at the time, probably against all reason, that it would be out of reach of the U.S. courts, out of reach of the Geneva Conventions, and they could continue to hold detainees there without giving them access to the U.S. courts.
Over time, the detainees at Guantanamo, though, more than just Afghans, correct?
Oh, absolutely. The first 20 in, which if you close your eyes and imagine men in orange jumpsuits on their knees and shackles with blinders on their eyes, those first 20 men in included an Australian, Yemenis, yes, a few Afghans, but a lot of Arab men, actually. Because if you remember, Guantanamo was set up just months after the September 11th attacks, and they were looking for Osama bin Laden. They were looking for Mullah Omar. They were fairly desperate to figure out if there were sleeper cells out there planning more attacks on U.S. targets. And so they brought these men in, put them in cages, and started interrogating them.
Yeah, it's hard to forget those photos of those men in flame orange jumpsuits and on their knees. When he took office, President Obama promised to close Guantanamo within a year. Why hasn't that happened, and what is the essence of that dilemma for the president?
I think the best answer is that when he took office, he thought that he would take a look at the detainees and either try them or let them go, and in a very short amount of time realized that there was a third category that he wanted to have, indefinite detainees, not criminals, but prisoners in this endless war, this war on terror. And then the other short answer is Congress wouldn't let him, because the reality is the Obama plan pretty soon, within about a year, became closing Guantanamo didn't mean getting out of the Guantanamo business. It meant moving those prisoners to the U.S., and Congress blocked that systematically.
There have been so many different nationalities of detainees released over the years. There were Uyghurs, low-level people, cooks, drivers. I want to talk to you about this recent release, the five Taliban commanders in the swap for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. We've heard so much about this. What is the part of the story that we have not heard?
I think the most interesting part about those men is that in many ways they weren't typical of Guantanamo detainees.
Why not?
Well, I think if people know anything about Guantanamo or think they do, they think that all the prisoners are getting in fights with the guards, resisting their detention, going on hunger strike, being force-fed, going to court, challenging their detention. These five men did none of that. One of them did go to court, and his lawyer took his case to court, and he lost. But these guys were more like war prisoners, prisoners of war, than many people at Guantanamo. They didn't fight with the guards. They followed the rules. They lived in communal detention where they were allowed to eat together, pray together, do sports together. And when you'd get taken around on these tours, you would see what they called the cooperative captives, the communal captives, sitting around rec yards, living in bunkhouses. And these five men were among them invariably because they had a different attitude toward the detention. And I'm telling you this because I know this from the military, not from these men. I've never been allowed to talk to a detainee down there until after they've gotten out and called me. But I know that these men lived as medium security cooperative captives, meaning they didn't get put in lockdown. They weren't inside cells alone because they followed the rules. They were waiting for what happened, which is the deal that would, in essence, release them as war prisoners.
How many detainees are currently in Guantanamo? Do you have a number?
149.
149. Do we have any sense of when they will be released? Presumably progressively, but
so
when?
Six are in active trials, and those are men accused of the 9/11 attacks and the USS Cole bombing, for which the Pentagon prosecutor not only wants to convict them, but have them executed. Of the 149, there's another batch, which are 78 of them, who were cleared for release, almost all of them, years ago. They can go home. They can go to Yemen, or they could go, theoretically, to Yemen, Syria, Tunisia.
Why are they still there?
Because this administration and the administration before, both Bush and Obama, don't trust the Yemenis to keep an eye on them, to rehabilitate them. So what they're trying to do is figure out how to negotiate their release to circumstances that are, if not rehabilitation from having been jihadis, then rehabilitation from having spent up to 13 years at Guantanamo and likely hating the Americans who kept them.
So these are some of the troublesome issues posed by Guantanamo. Let's get into, like, physically the facility. Take us down there. You get off the plane in Guantanamo. What do you actually see?
It's a little town. It's 45 square miles, and it's split up across the bay, Guantanamo Bay. And where you land is just like any other little town airstrip, out of town, on the other edge of it. You ride a ferry, you go across, and it's small town America. It has a church, a golf course, a McDonald's, a couple of bars, and since 2002, a prison.
Does it look, I mean, aside from that prison, does it look like small town America?
It sure does. It sure does. It, like I said, it has a McDonald's. It has a golf course. It has an elementary school because while the prison is staffed by 2,200 Pentagon employees who come and go in 6, 9, 12-month rotations and work at the prison complex, which is on one end of the base, the rest of the base is a Navy base that has a port and an airport and a school and, like I said, a downtown.
Can you actually buy Cuban beer or cigars or rum?
No, this is America, and it is bound by all of the American restrictions. No Cuban products come in. We do still have that embargo, you know, the political embargo that was put in. So the rum is Jamaican or Puerto Rican, and the cigars are never Cuban, with the exception of when the base commander leaves, the Navy captain who runs the base, has nothing to do with the prison again, he is presented with a box of cigars by his Cuban counterpart as kind of a farewell gift.
Is that kind of a ritual that goes back years?
It's been going on for quite a while, and I've been going there for about 12 or 13 years, and you hear about the cigars arriving because everybody wants to be the best friend of the base commander for that box of cigars. So he can't take it with him either, right? Smoke it or leave it.
Now, Carol, earlier you pointed out that you have zero communication with the detainees when you're at Guantanamo. They do call you from time to time when they get out. How does that actually work, and what kind of things have you discussed?
So it's interesting. You know, I've spent years looking at these men through the wire, trying to not be a gawker, but trying to write their stories. And I think, you know, that the idea that they would not have access to the courts ended with the Supreme Court giving them access to habeas corpus petitions. So they got lawyers. They got American defense attorneys. And American defense attorneys would tell them, among other things, about who these reporters were. On one instance, years ago, I had a detainee walk up to the fence and say to me, "Hey, do you work for National Geographic?" And if I'd answered him, I wouldn't be going there anymore because you're not allowed to talk to a detainee. So my point being, there's a certain amount of curiosity by the ones who aren't in lockdown about who are these reporters who come and go. And their lawyers sometimes send them articles. And sometimes when they get out, they get packets of articles. So on occasion, I have gotten either a phone call or an email from a detainee I've written about. And it's really simple. They don't say much. They basically say, "Thank you for telling my story." Mm. They don't ask questions. They don't necessarily want to give information. They just realized, probably because their attorneys told them, that somebody had been covering this story that's been mostly forgotten for the past 12, 13 years. And for whatever reason, they want to thank me.
Do you expect you'll be getting a call from those five Taliban commanders at some point?
We're trying to sort out whether there's a restriction on them because I want to go talk to them. Mm. My organization and I would like to get me to Doha, I've been before, to sit down and talk to them.
What do you want to find out?
I want to know what it was like for them. I want to know how they saw Guantanamo. I mean, I know that for a lot of people, particularly the hunger strikers and the people who were forced fed, it has been a miserable year or two. It has been a very difficult year down there. And I'm not thinking that these guys are going to be particularly complimentary of their captors or, you know, grateful for their experience with the Americans, but they've had a different experience at Gitmo. It's hard to call them elders because these guys are functionally in their 30s, I think, maybe young 40s. But they were kind of the elders there. So they have actually a perspective. Some of them, at least one of them, is a military commander. Talking to him may be very similar to talking to people who worked at the detention center who are officers. One of them was, I believe, with intelligence and the information ministry. I wonder if he's a little bit like the spokesman down there. I'm interested in what they're like and what they have to tell me. I mean, it's a very strange beat where you don't get to talk to one person who's part of the story.
I was just going to say, how do you stay motivated on a story like this when you can't kind of do the things that journalists usually do, get quotes and talk to the subjects who are the center of the story? I mean, what's that like and how do you stay on it?
So for the first couple of years, it was really frustrating because it was a one-sided story and the military, while they were far more welcoming than they are now and far more willing to entertain questions than they are now, the military is not particularly media friendly at the moment down there. But for the first 4 years or 3 years, it was really just the U.S. side of the story. But then they got lawyers. And the lawyers who are American pro bono defense attorneys, or habeas counsel, as they call them, got to tell their stories. And so after a few years, it didn't feel like you were telling one side of the story. You had somebody who could convey their version of not the truth, but their truth. Or their version of the truth, which is important and maybe not that dissimilar from covering other stories where you speak to people through their attorneys.
Indefinite detention, starvation protests, and force feeding. I mean, it's not surprising that Bo Bergdahl's father last week called Guantanamo a stain on the American soul. But even if Guantanamo gets shut down, what do you think its legacy is going to be?
So there's Guantanamo, the base, which has done many things through the years, including been a safe haven for a humanitarian relief for people found at sea. There's Guantanamo, the gas station. There's Guantanamo, the place that has produced, you know, Navy sailors' families for years. And then there's Guantanamo detention. And Guantanamo detention is the idea that you can hold somebody forever without charging them with a crime or putting them to trial, because we had or have this endless war with an enemy that has nobody who can surrender. And I think that's what Guantanamo is, the concept will be for a long time. The American challenge to figure out how to end a war that did not start on the battlefield and will not end on the battlefield, if it ever ends, and what you do with human beings that you consider prisoners of that war.
If the war is endless, is your fear then, Carol, that Guantanamo, the detention center, will never close?
If the question is it my fear that this will be the only story I ever cover?
Let's take that question first. Is that your fear?
Okay, because I don't know how to discuss the fear of endless Guantanamo. I can tell you that I sort of concluded a couple of years ago that this may be the last story I cover, that this detention center may continue past my retirement, that I could continue covering this story for the next 20 years.
How does that make you feel to be on that for the rest of your career?
So for me, Guantanamo started off as an assignment that morphed into an obligation because other people didn't want to see it, didn't want to cover it. It's hard to cover Guantanamo. And now it's like this beat like no other beat I've ever covered. You know, I was a reporter in the Middle East. And there's something satisfying about having this unique beat and feeling that you are asking the questions for the American people that they want asked. Even when the military down there, like now, refuses to answer the questions and are really trying to pretend like there's no legitimate question and Guantanamo can exist forever without anybody noticing. So I guess how do I feel? It's satisfying to continue covering something that I think is very important and more reporters should cover. On the other hand, if more people would climb on, then maybe I wouldn't feel that obligation.
Carol Rosenberg with the Miami Herald, thanks so much. And thanks for staying so rigorously on the story.
Thank you.